Welcome to episode 120 of the Nerds Assemble podcast.
This week we'll be looking at Mass Effect, Life is Strange, House of Cards, Jam Game, Pete's Dragon, and our feature, Can Creators on Kickstarter Ask to Feed Themselves?
Hi, I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
I'm Paul, aka Retroid.
I'm sorry to say that we do not have a cookie this week, but we have been joined by Kevin Furlong of the Level Up Video Game Pod Quiz.
Kevin says hi.
Can I just say that when you say that we don't have a cookie, we actually mean like a guest called Cookie, affectionately. Not, you know, an actual cookie.
Mind
just
you,
just in case that
maybe
confuses
we
people.
Should have a standby cookie. That is a standby cookie.
But it wouldn't say anything. Because it's a cookie.
I've got some chocolate biscuits downstairs, but I think they'd be absolutely crap actually talking.
But they would crunch well. It'd be a satisfying bit of crunching and munching sounds.
It'd be crunch time.
See, I've got a four-year-old. When you say chocolate biscuits downstairs, that means a completely different thing in this house.
Uh-oh. As ever, you can find the show notes for this episode over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk, where you can comment, find links to our social accounts. You can also get in touch and ask us questions or comment on the show by email at contact@nerdassemble.co.uk, or you can try tweeting us at nerdspodcast. Also, we'd really appreciate it if you could answer the listener survey we've started. There's a link in the show notes, or you could try and fill it out right now at bit.ly/nerds2015. So newsy things. I'm not sure how big of a revelation this was last week.
Revelation. See, I'm not the only one.
Yeah.
Jam Game.
But it was revealed that by Jonathan Cooper, one of Mass Effect's main game designers, that Shepard was originally a woman, and the first screen animation test for Shepard involved a female set of wiry avatar-y thing.
Business.
The motion capture was basically female.
Yeah.
Woo!
Biologically accurate as well.
Yeah.
So. And that's because Femme Shep is brilliant, and that's the only way to play it.
But then this revelation that the female character was considered first means that it's Shepard and Bro Shep. Yeah?
See, I don't get making the distinction. I've never understood the whole Femme Shep and Man Shep thing. It's just Shepard. It's just, I don't get the need to say Femme Shep. It's just something I've never understood.
At the same time, it's if you play as a female Shepard, it's a very different experience to the standard sci-fi save the world, I'm the one kind of game.
Well, it's no longer kind of a marine romp, space marine romp type thing.
Yeah, it's because she's not. It's not even like she's the kind of, well, unless she play as a renegade, it's not even like she's kind of like the hard ass women that you kind of get in Starship Troopers. She's kind of more refined than that.
Well, you can kind of play her how you like, to be honest.
Yeah, you could. Though if you start being an ass as Shepard, as a woman, then you start to sound like some of the women that were in Starship Troopers.
It's just to me, she's a better voice actor than, you know, the man Shep.
Who voices Bro Shep?
I don't know.
Silence.
I don't care, because I only hear him when I play evil.
So half
the time he's wandering through the game with half his face on fire or hanging off, kind of.
After the events of Mass Effect 2.
And people saying, "So, Shepard, what should we do?" And, you know, Shepard's, you know, like, got someone in an arm lock and grinding his knuckles on the top of their head going, what? Or he's strangling a puppy. Just, you know, just generally evil things, because it's like, yeah, Man Shep can be that. So my custom Femme Shep is just going to save the universe. Because she's brilliant.
In related news, it was revealed by the Life is Strange developers last week in a developer diary that before Square Enix took on publishing their game, or saying they were going to publish it, that other games publishers wanted them to change the genders of their protagonists to guys. Currently it's ladies, and it's staying as ladies. And apparently Square Enix were the only publisher that they sort of, you know, showed the game to that was keen to not do anything different to the game.
Let me guess, it was the whole logic of, oh, people like playing as men, and they'll feel strange playing as female characters.
I don't think any real justification was given, other than obviously people would have, you know, marketing and similar would have probably got involved at some point during the other pitches, going, oh, we can't market this to, you know, gamers if it's a women. It's the women's.
They were probably worried about, you know, the expense of animation. I mean, after all, women have got, six limbs and the head that splits down the middle. You know, all of that weird stuff that the Assassin's Creed Unity bloke was talking about. You know, very expensive to animate.
Have you been, like, dating xenomorphs or something?
Damn.
I'm sorry, I'm getting flashbacks to which of the Alien films? It's not the first, it's not the second, might be the third. With the whole weird xenomorph thing, and it can finally just give birth rather than lay eggs, and it's just fucking creepy.
Yeah, that's the fourth one. Alien Resurrection.
Yeah, that was so creepy.
But that's because it was biologically mutated, was it? With the sharing of the gene pool.
Ripley had given it something that she wasn't meant to. Bad idea. I'm going to move this on, though, because I can't talk this on, you know, other than the fact that playing as a female shepherd is a very interesting experience,
and it's basically, the point was, is that it was kind of originally kind of a female, that was the first kind of one, as it were, female shepherd.
Although that, again, just purely from a logistics point of view, that mostly that was because it was left over from Jade Empire, wasn't it,
something like that? So it would have made sense, but still. Not that Jade Empire is one of those games where I've been over the years like, do I really want to play it? Do I?
No, let it go.
Yeah.
Sometimes you've just got to let it go.
To give you an idea, I played through it up until I think the final mission.
Oh, yeah.
Where it was, you know, if you choose to do this now, you can't go back, all that kind of thing, and then your party goes to, you know, this location, and then I stopped playing and have never gone back. It was just so obviously not a KOTOR. We've got these good people and there's some evil people and they can use kind of magic-y things and they're warriors and, you know, the bad people are like an underground sect and they're definitely not Sith. And it's... I got the feeling it was slightly racist, just in its its spin on Asian mythology. It's just, you know, not sure if.
Maybe for the best, I haven't played it then. Meanwhile, in other completely unrelated news, a teaser trailer for House of Cards Season 3 has dropped, with dramatic background music. And worrying scenes of public dissent and Frank Underwood looking like he's slowly cooking himself.
In fairness to the trailer, it made me want to watch the first season, so I might do that.
Well,
I've not seen any of them, but again, seeing that trailer, I thought I've missed something here.
You've got a few weeks now to catch up. You've got over a month to watch the first two seasons before season 3 drops on the 27th of February. I like how Netflix keeps choosing the weekend of Paul and Mine's anniversary to release seasons of House of Cards, because I wasn't able to watch it when it came out last year because it was our 10th anniversary last year. I wasn't allowed to watch it on the weekend because we were off on a romantic anniversary thing for a whole weekend, and it's going to be sort of like a similar deal this year, and it's just like... I don't know.
What's happening this year?
I don't know. We haven't decided on our plans yet. But it won't involve watching House of Cards Season 3. I know that.
No.
So, I think I need to...
I get the sick feeling Paul's just kind of be pushing a certain direction. I don't know what we're doing yet, but we're doing this.
It was like about, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. No, February the 14th. What was that? It was Mass Effect 2 demo day.
I like it.
That's what it was.
Oh, no, I think because Kingsman, the Secret Service thingy film, I think that's coming out on in and around Valentine's Day this year, as is Fifty Shades of Bullshit. And, you know, that...
Dr. Gillian McKeith will be in her element.
See, I didn't know anything about that Kingsman until I saw the trailer yesterday. Mm. And all of a sudden I was like, hello, what's this? Why haven't I heard about this? What's going on?
Ooh. Well, that's because they decided they were sort of first two-thirds of last year, maybe first half of last year, they were pushing it. And then they switched the release date from October last year to February. And that's why it suddenly disappeared. So they just started the promotion machine going, and then they kind of pulled back because they pushed back the release date.
Can I just say that? It's nice. Probably a good thing that we've now got our own car, because we're going to be going to the cinema loads this year, aren't we?
Yes. If you're a piece up on Hex today, don't anything to go by. First thing, we need to try and get a chance to watch those Birdman.
Yes.
Yeah, I want to see that as well. Mm.
But I
very rarely get to the cinema except with having the little people. I don't have little people.
I rarely get to the cinema because I hate people.
Well, yeah, that can be an issue too. Yep.
Because it's, oh, yeah, you're here to see a film, and so am I, and I paid close to a tenner for the honour, and it's great, and that's why you're talking all the way through the fucking film. I'm going to kill you.
See, part of the reason why me and Emily sit at the front now is so that we don't have to watch people basically just play with their phones on the front row.
Oh, that annoys me more than people talking.
Mm.
It's if you go and see a film which is, you have enough to take kids to. Mm. The number of times I've had a parent sitting there doing nothing while their little angel kicks the back of your chair.
Mm.
Yeah, I've been to a few screenings like that. I've just wanted to kill people.
If I picked them up and threw them down the aisle, I would be the one getting in trouble.
Yeah.
But yeah, House of Cards, really looking forward to it. And everyone here should watch the original UK version as well.
Is that still on Netflix? It was at one point.
I don't know. I've got the trilogy on DVD, so.
Mm.
Just as an interesting thing, a friend of ours called Nick, he was kind of experiencing the sing-along Frozen type thing.
Oh, God.
When there's like loads of kids around, and it was apparently it was just bedlam in there.
Okay, the lesson here is if anyone else from from Cornwall who has youngins and has taken their kids to a sing-along screening in the past few months, and either your kids or those of your neighbours were ill-behaved during the screening, you've made at least two people's lives hell in the past few months. And I hope you feel, disgusted by yourselves.
Maybe the sad thing is
they probably don't.
Cinema employees should not be finding slices of salami down down between the seat cushions after a screening.
No, they should be stuck to the screen. Just throw them better.
Especially when that poor cinema employee's a vegan. That's just nasty.
Mm.
And cruel and unusual punishment.
I feel that pain.
I'm just thinking that maybe kids under like a certain age, like 15 or so, should be just kind of wearing Hannibal Lecter style kind of straight jackets and the mask while watching absolutely anything.
Possibly kids under the age of 20.
Yeah. Possibly even like up to about 25 or so.
I think if you go to the cinema before 4 o'clock, you get everything you deserve.
You say that, but then it depends what film you go to see, because I remember going to I've mentioned it loads of times, screening of Van Helsing that I went to see after I finished my exams.
Mm.
And it was an afternoon screening, and it was just blissfully empty. At the whole cinema screen to myself.
If the schools are on and it's an afternoon screening, then you're probably in luck.
Yeah, you're set, aren't you? Again, yes. It depends on the film rating as well. If it's obviously if it's a family film, Yeah, yeah, you're going to get kids there in the early hours.
Van Helsing, to be honest, 12A.
Yeah. Well,
strictly speaking, nobody under 8 should be in that, so you'd expect some degree of behaviour.
I think, I'll just paint a picture of, you know, one of my worst cinema experiences. Went to see King Kong.
Oh, you've told me enough.
And I had a moment with 4 children sitting behind me.
Mm-mm.
Can you imagine what, you know, and they were youngish, you know, 10, if that. Can you imagine what that would be like watching that film for, you know, over 3 hours? Because it's about that, isn't it?
It is a long remake, yes.
Mind you, one of the most annoying things was when they kept saying monkey. Say it's a nope!
That's when you start flinging poop at them.
I like characters in the films getting things wrong like that, because people would say, yeah, it's a big monkey. Yeah, so I like that. I like things like that in films. So.
But it was the kids behind me.
Oh, right.
I say, but they were already annoying me because it was stuff, you know, like kicking the backers of, you know, the seats and the occasional smoldering in the back of my head.
I can just envision it now. I hope I'm never charged for taking my brother and a bunch of his friends to the cinema.
Oh God!
And having them misbehave, because now that I got the car, that is a scary possibility. Oh God!
You just talked yourself into a nightmare there, haven't you?
Yeah, it's just I could imagine Josh. I could probably get him to behave. But his
You've been to the cinema with him twice already.
But his little friends, some of them are annoying. Some of them I've had arguments in the past about what machinery is.
Yeah.
This was a bowling trip a few years ago. One of the first times he'd gone bowling for his birthday, my brother Josh and one of his little friends kept putting his hand near the ball dispenser. And I was like, stop doing that. That machinery will rip your hand off. And this boy was like, that's not machinery. It's not a tractor. It's not on a farm. And I'm like, machinery is stuff other than tractors, you small little child. And then he was like, who do you think you are? And I was like, Josh's big sister. Now get away from it. And he scampered off.
You're not the one getting in trouble if the hand gets whisked away.
No.
What you said was obviously the tractive unit is the plant. It's the thing, it pulls it to the machinery.
Okay. So House of Cards Season 3 coming back. You see, we really like it because it kind of rings with some of our murderous intentions that we seem to have and desires. Yes,
I've got my little, Underwood flag and hat going, go on, woo!
Chris Spann has launched a game jam with a difference. Jam game, the backwards game jam.
Jam.
See, that's why I was getting problems.
Yep.
But it could have worked either way. And you didn't tell me that.
No, I made you redo the introduction, which you will not hear several times before we start recording this episode proper.
See, what they should have called it Magimag.
I think you might need to explain that a little more.
It's game jam backwards.
But then the whole idea was to do it more. It's like you just switch names of existing games around to then develop a game around that theme. So instead of it being Far Cry, Cry Far. Oh. Imagine this is a game about trying to cry as far as you can, either, you know, actual crying of tears or shouting, screaming.
Is that where you actually play as children in the cinema trying to get Retroid to cry as much as he can and as far as he can?
It would be less crying and more what happens when Bruce Banner gets annoyed.
I think,
except with more hair.
I think,
and a beard.
I saw that part-time indie developer Felnot, Christos Reed.
Yeah.
I think he said he's developing. So it's not Sid Meier's Civilization.
Mm.
It's civilization. So Sid's going to be going around stealing artifacts.
Right. From civilization.
From civilization. I think. So that's going to be interesting to see. Another suggestion that was on the Jam Games Game Jam page was Slug Metal.
I can't believe anybody's, you know, kind of come up with, or, you know, that isn't on there, Evil Resident. Because that's...
that's going to be interesting. You could still have it as zombies, though. It's just incredibly evil, slightly more with it zombies.
See, there's a few you could have a lot of fun with. You know, like, I'd quite like to see Man-Bat.
That would be good.
Mm-hmm. It's also a character in Batman.
Effect Mass would probably be quite a good game.
It would be very physics-based.
Yeah. Mm.
I'd quite like to play Giraffe Space. Space Giraffe. Which would be, maybe just the space where a giraffe is.
Combat Mortal, where you're
just killing loads of regular people.
Yeah. That's this is Combat Mortal.
Dangerous Elite would be the game about a dangerous elite segment of society that's killing everyone below it. So kind of like the Tory Party, only a little bit more metaphorical. Because it's the dangerous elite, not the dangerous Tory party.
How about Solid Gear of Metal, where it's actually a puzzle game about machinery?
Yeah.
I think I've played puzzle games like that.
Oh, come on, somebody think of another one.
Rain Blood?
Raining Blood, yeah. Rain Blood, yeah. Yeah, that could work. I'm trying to... It's
annoying. Space Dead.
Space Dead. Us of the Last doesn't quite work.
No,
definitely. Raider Tomb does not work at all.
What about Saga Unlimited? Does that still say that still almost has the same meaning as Unlimited Saga? I'm just looking at game collection to the right.
Fantasy Final.
Hill Silent? That kind of sounds like it's a poetry type, you know, art game.
See, I wish I was in the... My game collection is in the next room. Because otherwise I could be going down my list and just going, there we go, yeah.
Dear listeners, if you have suggestions for Jam Game Game Jam games, tell us. It sounds funny. If you want to enter this yourself, though, anyone can actually get involved. And you can use whichever your preferred dev tools, from Twine to Unity. So, you know, text-based is fine. Or you can get your graphics and your physics in there if you want.
You could have You Zombie, where you basically just go around accusing people of being zombies.
Yes!
You Zombie!
Unfortunately, that would also then lead to You Wii, which is more of an accusation than a games console.
The deadline for entries is the 16th of February, and you'll be able to find the link for Jam Game Game Jam on the show notes. I'm going to move us to our final bit of news for this week, in which I found out that they're remaking the Disney classic Pete's Dragon.
That's very charitable use of the word classic.
Mm. It feels a bit like Disney scraping the bottom of the barrel there for things to remake.
Like they haven't already.
Again, I think that's being very generous.
Yep.
I suppose it depends what they're going to do with it, because the original, as I remember, it was just dire. But if they were going to do something more along the lines of Harvey, but have a dragon and a kid instead of a clearly mentally disturbed middle-aged man... it might work.
There is a
kids film.
Apparently, unlike the original, it will not have any singing, which is perhaps a good thing.
Always a good thing.
Yeah. So no singing. Yeah. And
the only singing film I can really let go is I wasn't thinking of that.
Yeah, but you should have chosen your words more carefully.
I can allow is Little Shop of Horrors.
Quality film.
Mm. See, there we go. There's a musical which proves that musicals don't have to be crap.
What about Rocky Horror?
Well, yes.
I like Jerry Springer the Opera. It's quite fun and controversial. You know, as far as musicals go.
Not seeing it. I'm a big Jesus Christ Superstar fan, though.
I've seen two versions of it. It's interesting trying to compare a secondary school version of it versus a, you know, proper all singing, all dancing, expensive tickets version.
So would the primary school version, well, secondary school, yeah, would that be sort of slightly cleaned up?
It was slightly cleaned up. I would say they had more heart in it when I saw that in comparison to the professional version.
Which professional version did you see?
It was some travelling lot. They pulled up a great big tent in one of the parks down here and sort of were there all week sort of thing, basically. It wasn't like it was the West End. But it was a travelling lot.
Yes. I know it's quite, not quite with it, but what was it, the Repo Man? That was a weird one. Some of the songs I kind of liked, but...
Yeah, that yeah. Repo Man, that was weird, because it was like a rock opera, but some of the songs were quite well written, others weren't. It had Anthony Stewart Head in it and Paris Hilton. And I think a couple of other names. Yeah, exactly. It's a rock opera. It you can usually find it cheap somewhere.
It was weird because it had such a mismatch of skills. You know, working on that film. You know, you can see the script writing being absolutely terrible. Some of the songwriting being good. Some of it being absolute crap. Some of the acting being absolutely brilliant. Some of the camera work being good. Some of it being crap. And it's just. It's a mismatch of, you know, kind of production values. It's kind of weird.
Going back to the Pete's Dragon situation, which has no singing.
Is it? Must we?
It does, however, now it was confirmed, this is why it came to my attention, that Michael C. Hall has been cast in it. Dexter has been cast in a children's film.
That's, yeah.
That's a bit cruel on Michael C. Hall. You know, he didn't really kill people.
I know he didn't really kill people, but he's never
just playing a part.
I've never seen him play a child-friendly role. I mean, he, you know, the thing that sort of really made his name, which was Six Feet Under.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a gay undertaker.
What's not child-friendly about a gay undertaker?
It was more the undertaker part about it. And also, he was really bad at keeping... People could walk on him too easily, like his poor mum and stuff, when things were going on, because they were all in the same house still. It was, so many embarrassing things happened in that TV series.
Sure, I quite liked him in Gamer as well.
That was definitely not a kid-friendly film.
No, definitely not. There's certain things that I quite liked about Gamer.
You know, where it's, just with it being called Gamer.
Go back to the six
feet. I think it would have been better without Gerard Butler.
Going back to his role as 6 feet under, it wasn't that I was against the gayness of that. It was just how everything always seemed to go a bit wrong with him and his relationships and how much level of control his character had over them. So despite him trying to cover things up for a lot of like the first two seasons, things would always go a bit awry. And I was always worried people were going to find things that he didn't want them to find.
I really need to finish watching that.
Yeah, you know, bits of paraphernalia in that. But has he ever been in a kids thing?
No.
Yeah, I was.
I'm wondering. does he have any kids now? Because he married what's her face from Dexter, didn't he?
His sister.
Yes.
What? Seriously?
Not his real sister.
The woman who played his sister. She played his adopted sister. So
I did not know that. Bloody hell. I mean, it's slightly better than, you know, Woody Finjicky.
The thing is, going back to who else has been cast in this Pete's Dragon remake, Robert Redford is on the cast list at the moment. Bryce Dallas Howard and Wes Bentley, and Oakes Fegley is going to be playing the title character. So I'm assuming Pete, child that has been anything before, which is fine, you know, because kids, you know, newcomers, makes sense. But I just don't understand, where is Michael C. Hall going to be playing a bad guy in this, or is he going to be playing a good guy? Because I'd like to see him play a good guy. I'm just going to be watching this purely for seeing or hearing. We don't know what role he's got yet.
That's very true. But it's going to be kind of weird, like, if he's like the voice of Pete, you know, the dragon. Because then you kind of half expect him to, you know, kind of set up a kill room.
Wouldn't that be a burn room?
Probably would be.
For those of you who are unaware, the original Peach Dragon truly was a disappointing 1970s Disney film.
Disappointing. You are being very generous.
Yep. I have very distant memories of it from watching it as a child. And far more memories of Beethoven and Home Alone.
I'm sorry.
So, yeah. I'm going to move us on now to what we've all been up to. And because Kevin is our guest, he gets to go first. So, Kevin, what have you been up to?
What have I been up to? I've been up... Well, when I'm not destroying my youngest at Metroid Blast on Nintendo Land. The guy's a total noob. I've been playing a resource management, people placing strategy game on the iPad. It's based on the board game Stone Age. And what's kind of surprised me about this is, when thinking about what I've been doing this week, I never even gave that a thought until just before we started, and I sat down to play it while I was waiting. And that's it dawned on me that that's what I've kind of been doing for the past week. Every time I sit down, I'm picking it up and I'm playing that, because it's about 10-15 minutes for a game. It's very light, very easy to play. And I'm not a big fan of strategy games, but it sits quite comfortably because it's based on a board game that doesn't have a lot of social interaction. And that in itself I find quite interesting, because I think the iOS version works a lot better than the board game version would do. Because part of the reason I bought it was because I was considering buying the board game version. But having played it now on iOS, you're very much, you're doing your own thing. You place your people. You start off with, it reminds me a little bit of Populous. You start off with a limited number of people, and there's other tribes. In the first round, you place your people and you take it in turns. There's three buildings you place them in. One would give you access to farming. One is mating. The other one is tool production. But you can't use them all at the same time. So you're placing one. The next person may take another one. You've then got buildings you can claim, which advances your civilization. And you've got trading, which you can do with boats that come in. Different levels up of the boats require a different number of resources you have to trade with to get the resources that they hold. You get your resources by going into fields, either by cutting down wood, mining for rocks, and mining for gold. They all have different values, which are used to trade for the buildings. So obviously the gold would give you more victory points for the buildings that you need the gold to buy with. Mm. Sorry, I'm getting a little bit muddled up here, but that's what I mean. But it's very much you're doing your own thing to advance your civilization and gain your victory points. The only real interaction you have with the other players is when you're trying to block them. If you think they need a particular resource, you can go into that quarry or that field and potentially stop them from being able to harvest it, which would stop them getting the resources they need to advance their civilizations and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it's not a game you'd really communicate with each other over. So in that sense, the iOS version, I think, works a lot better, because instead of it being an hour and a half of sitting around the table not talking to your mates, it's 15 minutes on a couch on your own. So, and it's cheap. So it's about a fiver.
Does it have in-game purchases?
Absolutely not.
Good.
That's always good.
Having said that, a lot of the iOS stuff that does have, particularly in relation to the board games, when they have in-app purchases, it tends to be the expansions. You buy the base game, as you do with the board games. You buy the base game, and you can play that quite happily. the board game of Stone Age does have an expansion, but they haven't got that on the iOS version yet. If they do, then I'm sure that would appear as an in-app purchase. But at the minute, no, it's just the base game. And as I say, I've probably put about 5 or 6 hours into that this week without even realizing it, without appreciating what I've done. So that was great. And for a bit of family time, it took the little people to see Big Hero 6.
Did they behave?
They were angels. I'm a fantastic parent. Having said that, my youngest is 4, so you get a lot of, why is he doing that? What's that? What's going on here? But it's just a case of leaning into him and then just saying, talk quietly. Shh, what's that, sunshine? You know, and keeping his face stuffed with popcorn.
Okay.
I'm approving of that.
I'm especially approving of the popcorn.
Well, you say that. There was this one point when we took my little brother to the cinema over the summer and we bought him popcorn, and then my parents hadn't told me that he'd been having issues every time he'd eaten popcorn recently and that there was a slight choking hazard. So there was this great moment where I had to sacrifice my almost full bottle of water because he'd already got through his like little juice thing whilst he was sort of half choking on some popcorn. That was great. So I was just like, here, have my bottle of water. No, I don't want it back. It's fine. You stopped choking, obviously, but I didn't have a drink for the rest of that film.
Didn't you share mine or something?
I stole some of yours, yeah.
Yeah. That's more like it's stealing.
Yeah. So what did you go see? Sorry, Kevin, what was it?
It was Big Hero 6, the new Disney one.
I'm looking at that.
It's not their best. It's a good film. It's very much a kid's film. Unusually, normally when you get these kids' films, there's a lot in it for the grown-ups as well. Big Hero 6, I didn't really feel that. I felt it was very much a kid's film. Yeah. That said, there were a couple of, personally, I had a couple of good belly laughs, a few tears, and it does have a big heart. And for that alone, it's worth going and watching. Because the heart isn't overly sentimentalized. Is that the right word?
Sentimentalized.
Sentimentalized, thank you. There you go. Right. It's very, for want of a better term, real, given the fact that it basically involves an inflatable robot. It's good.
Is it actually based on a comic by Marvel, or am I imagining that?
It is, okay. Yeah. I've not read the comic, so I can't do a comparison.
Okay.
And did you say this was Big Hero 6?
Yes.
Now, is that movie number 6 or just the name of the character?
Neither.
All right. Awesome. Okay. We got that clear.
It may only be a minor spoiler, but I don't want to say because... You do find out what Big Hero 6 is as part of the film, so I don't want to spoil it because I thought it was on general. We literally took the family down to New Brighton, walked into the cinema, Big Hero 6 poster. Oh, we'll see that. You know, 4 tickets for that, please, and off we went. And then we started people saying, "Is it out yet?" Of course, it's out. We've been to the cinema to see it, but apparently not. Apparently, it was like a preview thing, and it's not actually on general release until the end of the month.
I can't admit, I've been looking at the cinema listings recently for our local cinema and I haven't seen it yet there. So I think
we just lucked out.
Absolutely.
It's just when you mentioned it, I thought, 6? Not out of the other 5. That would rather explain it.
But it's good. I would say it's worth a watch. If you've got kids, definitely go to the cinema and see it. It's a good cinema experience for kids. Other than that, maybe wait for it'll be on DVD for Christmas. Maybe pick it up then if you're a grown up.
or you kidnap younger relatives or your own children to go and see it. I mean, yes. That's how we legitimise seeing Paddington Bear.
Obviously, you don't kind of announce on social media that you're kidnapping somebody to do that.
Well, you know.
That would be a bad thing.
Okay. My parents willingly allowed me to, and Josh was willing to take him to the cinema to see Paddington Bear, for which he chuckled muchly over.
Although there was one bit where, something happened in the story, and we heard this like one kid at the back kind of wailing.
Yeah,
that was just like, oh come on.
They were clearly too young. Retroid, what have you been up to?
I have been playing Not Elite Dangerous.
Yay.
Well, I tell a lie, I have been, but I'm not going to talk about it. I have been playing, again, because I have played it, you know, over the years, including on the original release, which I found out was 20 years ago now. Jesus. Duke Nukem 3D on the Vita, because he was rather nicely part of the PlayStation Plus offering this month. So I thought, ooh, let's see how that works on the Vita. And as it turns out, really rather well, because it's on a nice, sharp, small screen. It's quite generous to the now aged, you know, 3D graphics and the, you know, the sprite based flat enemies. And yeah, I've been having a great blast on it.
To be honest, I can't imagine you and Duke Nukem. There's just too much kind of
baggage,
machismo.
Well, the whole thing with Duke Nukem 3D is that it is a huge piss take. It is not
okay
in any way serious, which I think Duke Nukem Forever made the massive mistake of probably taking it so far too seriously.
Mm.
Together with the, you know, the whole torturous development and just sticking the whole thing together with sellotape just to get it out the door and try and make some money back off it.
Well, I think you're absolutely right there. I think Forever was sticking its tongue out while as 3D was sticking a tongue firmly in its cheek.
Yeah. Duke Nukem 3D is, it's kind of the video game equivalent of those, you know, shit but great action movies that, you know, from the 80s, you know, like kind of, you know, mid to, you know, late 80s, where it would just be utterly ridiculous, but, you know, it's popcorn flick.
Cyborg cop.
Yeah, that kind
He's
of
He's a cyborg and a cop.
What could happen in a time of war? But, yeah, it's got a, you know, really nice level design. I still love a lot of the sound effects. It's just really well stitched together, and it was pretty good at the time. It was you know, the first time it tried to replicate slightly really worldy, even though they were, you know, piss take really worldy locations, at least, you know, for the first few levels. You know, for Hollywood and, you know, that kind of thing, and you'd sort of, you know, run down areas. Lots of interactivity, things like so many secrets that you could find in levels. So I found one which I don't think I'd ever found before on, you know, the first level. Hmm. And it's like, oh, bloody hell. You know, there's a secret there that explains why I never got 100%. But yeah, I've just been really enjoying that, and thinking it's a great pity that pretty much every single Duke game that came out after Duke Nukem 3D just kind of missed the point. To me, it's a little bit like, have you ever seen any of the Starship Troopers sequels?
Yes, we have. They are so terrible.
The first film, it's fairly obvious that it's the humans who are the bad guys.
Yeah.
And the whole thing is, you know, sort of being carried along by, it's like, you know, a horrible propaganda machine.
Yes, exactly.
Now, and everything after that, it's the humans are the good guys and they're fighting these bugs.
Hmm.
And it's just, how could you miss the point so badly? That to me is kind of how Duke Nukem 3D went.
Okay.
Where it's, you know, that one gets it right. And then the other ones, they think, ah, well, Duke Nukem 3D did this and that. We'll do, you know, we'll turn it up. And it's like, yeah, you're doing it entirely wrong.
To be honest, that sounds like a good concept for an article on X. Sorry. Just saying.
Yeah, but, well, actually, Eurogamer had a very good article, you know, over this weekend about Duke Nukem, seeing as it got a, because I think it's a new release on PS3 and Vita.
Hmm.
It previously came out on Xbox Live Arcade. And of course, it, you know, it's been updated, so it will run on modern PCs and everything like that. So, you know, I do own it on almost anything that it's possible to own it on. But it's just nice to sit down, especially on a handheld where you can just pick it up and, you know, instantly bring it back from suspend, play through a level, or, you know, get so far through the level and then just, you know, press the power button, suspend. There you go. You can do, go and do something else. So it's not a, I want to sit down and play this game.
Yeah.
Which can be a little bit of an impediment, depending on, you know, the type of game. If you're just wanting a fast go, then a handheld is, you know, the perfect sort of thing for it. And it works because the levels on these, most of them, you can, if you know what you're doing, you can complete them in maybe about 2 minutes, 2-3 minutes, gunning through them, literally.
So you're kind of making me regret not renewing my PSN subscription at the end of December.
I think PlayStation Plus is quite worth keeping, you know, keeping on. Because, they've got the Swapper as well, which I've installed. I've yet to actually play.
Swapper.
Yeah, the Swapper. Yeah, it came out on PC last year.
I have to admit, I haven't actually looked at PS Plus since it got updated this month, but I obviously clearly need to before things disappear.
I've heard nothing but good things about the Swapper, and that's another cross-buy one where it's possibly PS3, but definitely PS4 and Vita.
Yeah, I don't think it's on PS3. I think it is just 4 and Vita.
Yeah, which I still find really weird. It's like, if the Vita can manage it, I'm pretty sure the PS3 can. Surely, but not that I'm complaining.
Anything else you've been up to?
Well, I can't remember if I've mentioned it on here, but we watched Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which was quite a pleasant little film in a sort of post-apocalyptic ape. That's ape, definitely ape, no monkeys. Bloody people. Where the idea is that after the first film, the simian flu escapes and it it pretty much destroys civilization across the world. And this is a decade or so after humankind has pretty much been wiped out. And it's the story of the ape colony with Caesar, as played by the brilliant Andy Serkis again. And he's, you know, his various different, including, as I found out on some of the, you know, behind the scenes info, it's like, yes, that are some of the same ape characters apart from Caesar from the first film. Ones that he released from the research lab where it was kept. And say, oh, that's a nice link back. I'm going to have to watch the first one again because the first one was a very pleasant surprise after that remake of Planet of the Apes.
God, yeah.
Which was just crap. That was just a bad film. The story with this begins where the apes are out on a hunt and they stumble across some humans. And of course they're surprised as hell because so far as they knew, you know, the humans were gone. And as it turns out, some of the humans have holed up and survived in part of a nearby city. They've been using petrol generators, and that's running out. And the reason that they crossed, crossed paths with the apes on their hunting party was that they were on their way up to the hydroelectric dam to see if they could get that running again so they could power the city, because otherwise, you know, things go very bad with humans if, you know, there's no power and, you know, things get disorganized. And they're determined not to let that happen again. So it's after a bit of some tense encounters, one of the people goes up and manages to talk to Caesar and convince him that they're not wanting to invade, they're not wanting to hurt the apes. They just want a few people to try and get to inside the dam and get it running again, and then, you know, that's it. They'll leave the apes alone. And I'll just leave the, you know, the story synopsis at that. But yeah, it's a good film. And as always with Andy Serkis, he does a very good performance as Caesar. And you can imagine what happens when, you know, there's apes who are, you know, almost human, and people who are desperate in a situation. There's, you know, assholes happen. So yeah, it goes a little bit wrong in parts, but yeah, it's a good film, and it's one of my favorite I would say genre sci-fi, you know, that kind of thing.
Is it as good as the reboot, the first film in the reboot?
I think so, yes. It's different because it's, you know, its scope is different. But it has some references back, and yeah, I enjoyed it. If they do another one, I will be very pleased, and I'll definitely watch that. Oh, and if anyone is a fan of this, this is just, you know, my observation.
Excuse me, sorry.
You better not be coming down with the monkey flu. Sorry, ape flu.
Ape flu. It's simian flu.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. If anyone's a fan of Daily Show and things like that, and you know, John Hodgman, mm-hmm. who pops up every now and again as the, you know, deranged millionaire. Watch some of the behind the scenes thing, because the director of this, you know, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, to me, is John Hodgman's deranged millionaire.
Okay.
Because he's got the the face hair, backward combed hair, and he's got the little, you know, dicky bow tie, and he just, I was watching, you know, this whole thing of, you know, he's describing, you know, bringing this to life and, you know, things they did here and how they approached it and, you know, motion capture and blah, blah, blah. And I'm watching it, and I kept saying to my wife, that's John Hodgman, I swear. This is some weird undercover performance art he's doing. Anyway, yeah.
Maybe they didn't realise they didn't have their director. It's just he did waltz in one day after looking up the actual director in a cabinet somewhere.
Perhaps so. I'll see if I can find a picture of him.
Okay.
Because it's just John Hodgman. I swear. And, right, that's it.
Okay, Paul, what have you been up to?
I have been playing Captain Toad Treasure Tracker, which is kind of a solo adventure of Captain Toad and Toadette. And it's based around the concept of the Captain Toad's adventures from Super Mario 3D World. That awkward title. It's quite cool. It's kind of a bit of a puzzle game rather than just a straightforward platformer. So because you don't actually jump at all in it, and you kind of go around kind of this small kind of arena that you can kind of rotate and kind of see all the nooks and crannies of, and it's kind of up to you to figure out how to get all of the gems and then get the star as well.
Are you basically collecting the collectibles that Mario would otherwise take advantage of in other games? Because that's what it looked like.
Well, Mario never collects crystals or diamonds. So
he does in Super Mario Galaxy.
They're crystalline kind of star things, star bits. So it's not 100% the same, but but it's kind of an enjoyable little adventure.
When I saw you playing it, it reminded me of Fez.
In a way, it is a bit like that, because you're kind of constantly like rotating the kind of arena to try and figure out where to go next and to, you know, kind of how to get to certain hidden places and whatnot.
And is it the kind of rotatiness where say you're on a platform and there's a big gap and there's another platform, but if you rotate the land, then those two platforms will appear to join and then you can cross over that way.
It's, to a certain extent, it's actually almost like the opposite of that in a way, because, you know, you can kind of look at it from one perspective and you think that two platforms are kind of joining on. And in actual fact, you know, by rotating it, you actually see that it's literally just the angle. And, you know, you kind of end up having to kind of come off one platform to drop onto the next type thing. So
I'd have to see more of it being played, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, no doubt there's kind of, you know, YouTube clips and whatnot of it.
It's an adorable game.
It is quite an adorable game.
I have seen a few screenshots being posted on, you know, Facebook and, you know, Twitter of it, and it does look nice. Yeah. Although there was a voice screaming at the back of my head going, Fez! But that, I think that's fine.
If
someone fiddles with you know, the concept in a slightly different way, because after all, there was also Echo Chrome on the PSP,
okay,
which where you could have things. Because I was, anyone play Echo Chrome?
Doesn't ring a bell.
I was the only one who ever played it then,
ever.
But it was black and white, and it was kind of looked like a sort of, you know, Escher picture. And the idea was that you had a character who was just pacing around these platforms floating in space. And you could rotate the landscape so that if, you know, if there were two bits which were, you know, far apart, you could tilt the landscape and then, you know, slightly rotate it and move it so that they appeared to join, and then they would. And then the character would just sort of walk over what was once a gap, but, you know, now has no gap and is on you know, a completely different part of the landscape that they, you know, otherwise couldn't reach. But I don't think Echo Chrome did well, as has been evidenced by no other book of hearing of it.
But one of the things about Captain Toad Treasure Tracker is that there's kind of a selection of, if you've got New Mario 3D World thing for the Wii U, then you also automatically unlock some of the levels that from it, and they've been specially adapted so that you know, they can be kind of completed as, you know, kind of Captain Toad, though he can't kind of jump. So, you know, the platforms and whatnot have been kind of altered so that they're in kind of different positions, or there's different, you know, ways to do stuff. And
yeah,
it's quite a cool little puzzler, really.
Do you have to have actually unlocked those levels on 3D World before they come into Captain Toad, or do you just have to have like a save game from 3D World?
I think it's just save game.
Nice.
So, I know they seem to like doing like little rewards like that.
But, I approve of that kind of thing.
But anyway, Emily, what have you been doing?
Or reading. Lots of reading. I'm about halfway through the 5th edition book of Dungeons & Dragons Player Handbookness, and I want to say I know how multiclassing works, but I'm still a bit confused as to how the magic on that works, and I'm also equally confused as to how feats work in this version, but it's fine. I've got somebody I can talk to.
When they're plural, they're no longer feats, they're foots. No, wait, it's the other way around. Oh, God damn it.
That
joke. Tumbleweed.
Yeah.
Attempt a joke failed.
Oh, I know I was talking about it last week, but it is actually a lot easier to understand than previous editions, and I think it's going to allow for a lot of fun, which is a good thing. Every time I talk about it in a couple of circles, I suddenly get stuff being explained to me that the book had already told me, assuming that I hadn't managed to read it in the book, which is kind of annoying. I sort of put a thing on my Tumblr like, oh yeah, I've managed to read this much of the book now, and then I had somebody like explain like all the basic rules for combat, which were not exactly helpful in the way they wrote them, and were about to be told to me in the second half of the book.
Wait,
I've bought.
So all you put was that, oh, I'm this much through reading.
Yeah, with and a then picture people... of the second part, like, so you knew. It was like, look, part two, this is where I'm ending my lunchtime reading. I'm about to start it.
And then people try to explain what you've already read in the worse way than what you read it.
Would this be nerdsplaining?
A bit. It did feel like it. I already had some mansplaining today. That was bad.
Oh, hooray! Yeah.
The
other thing.
I'm not trying to stereotype myself in any way, but I have perhaps I've figured out the most of how to get the cooking facilities at work, because we have new offices going, which includes a cooker with grill and a microwave. Ooh. And I'm so far advanced with the grill cooker and the microwave that I can make myself toasted pita with brie and pepper, you know, for lunch in the grill, and then later on in the day, you know, make myself some microwave popcorn. But during lunchtime, when I was just waiting for the grill to warm up to put my pita in, I had a man folk come over and explain to me how complicated these things were. And
what
I was just
with you in there while things were still just switched on already.
Yeah, I just switched everything on. Like, it was just starting to warm up to reach the temperature I wanted it, so that I could put my pita and my cheese and pepper in, so that it would all melt together in a nice, lovely way. And this is,
And some guy just come over to explain what exactly?
To that, oh, isn't it complicated? And you know, you do this to do this. And I'm like, well, clearly I do, because freaking thing's heating up, I'm thinking to myself, but it's a small set of offices, so I can't be too rude.
Yes, you can.
Yes, you can. Yes, you can.
Yeah, very, very, very can.
it was like the thing was on and it was heating up, but you know, this heating up of oven and grill and pita and brie and pepper, that's going on at the same time as me I'm like reading Fifth Ed whilst I'm waiting for stuff to heat up and or cook. I don't know why you assumed I didn't get the high-tech kitchenware. I mean, it's kind of like a weird reverse stereotyping, because obviously it's usually assumed that a woman knows how to use all the cooking stuff. It was weird. But as soon as, like, maybe there's a limit now. It's like, if there's too much tech in it, the woman won't know how to use it.
Or maybe he thought that, oh, she's been reading a D&D book. Obviously, she's trying to pretend that she's a geek. And
I don't know.
trying to toast a sandwich with magic missile.
Or maybe he was just desperate to have a conversation with somebody.
I don't know. It didn't come off very well. A lot of guys don't,
to be fair.
But I like to say I know how to do multiclassing now, but I think I'm better at working the oven than figuring out how to make multiclassing work at the moment.
Well, just give it a little bit longer, reread it, and
it almost makes sense. I think it is just the magic that needs a little bit more rereading.
I still think that these rule books would be better as an app.
It
seems to be a very old-fashioned thing to do them as, you know, big tomy books.
See, part of the problem is, though, is that, you know, then you'd start to get the so-called proper D&D geeks looking down on the people that use the apps.
Yeah, but you've already got those, because I bet there's people who are saying, I'm still on second edition because everything after, you know, including...
That's me. Hello, me. What the hell? Everything after second edition is garbage. Yes, thank you.
Unless it's a guideline than a rule book.
I'm not paying any attention. You know that's true. There will be people.
Yeah, there will be. There was always people.
I think I've met some of them.
I mean, I remember when the first Iron Man film came out, and we knew this one guy that absolutely hated it because it wasn't set, because it was basically updated to be, you know, kind of kidnapped in Afghanistan rather than
Vietnam.
And it's like, really? It's an awesome film. You can't just leave it at that. No, you have to complain that it's not in the era that the comic originally was.
I do have a mate who has refused to watch the 1950s War of the Worlds, because it was updated to 1950s America, and it's not Victorian England.
Right.
Oh, my.
But it's just, it's a 1950s sci-fi. You weren't alive.
Shit if you see the Tom Cruise one.
Yeah.
I've seen the Tom Cruise one, and I do want to unsee it. Whereas the 1950s War of the Worlds is one of my, you know, all-time faves.
Other than FIFA D&D reading of rulebookness, I've also, now that Christmas is over, gone back to working on a geeky knitting project that I started last year, which is a Triforce cushion cover. And I'm now over halfway through working on it, so that is good. It's a slightly complicated thing to do though, because on account of them to basically make a picture and knitting, which is called intarsia in this particular instant. And
It's the original pixel art.
It does look there are things you can do to make it a bit smoother, but I realised that it'd be better to leave it looking blocky.
Yeah.
On account of its kind of, you know, gamer origin, rather than allowing it to be smooth.
Yeah.
But at the same time, and only people who knit will understand this, I'm not making a cushion cover of this size again on 4mm needles using double knit wool, because it's too small and it takes too long.
It's good. I've been doing this for hours and I've only got so much more done.
Yeah. It's a regular kind of wool. It's what you see a lot of stuff sort of knitted in that you might buy in a shop. It's not chunky stuff. It's just, it's not too thin. It's just regular kind of wool thickness double knit is.
Mm.
And it takes a while to knit stuff in it, especially like a cushion cover that's 300, it's going to be 300 rows altogether.
Bloody hell.
The problem I've got there is I don't know if that's a lot.
That's a lot. Yeah.
I'm kind of taking it from what you're saying, but I have no point of reference, so it's just...
Yeah. With this particular wool, 24 rows will give you 10 centimetres. So go from there.
You'd imagine there'll be more, you know, kind of maths geeks into knitting, considering
it would make knitting easier if we could get some math geeks involved, because then they could help break down patterns into more, like if you want to change a pattern, it'd be easier.
The amount of times that you've kind of gone on a knitting project and found that the instructions are wrong because the instructions are wrong, so you end up knitting something that doesn't look like what it's meant to.
That happened several times before Christmas, whilst I was knitting Christmas presents. I wasn't happy. But I want to move us away from knitting, point out, again, we're on iTunes, and if you do enjoy listening to us and you do so through iTunes, you're very welcome to leave a review for us there, if you, you know, so choose. But I want to go and move us on to our final feature of this week, which is based on events that happened sort of beginning part of last week, end of the previous week, and this, which is why I want to ask, can creators on Kickstarter ask to feed themselves? Author Stacey J, which is an alias, she has several pen names, had tried Kickstarter on a sequel to her novel The Princess of Thorns after it had been published by a regular publisher earlier in December last year, around the 9th. Mm. However, due to the publisher not being happy with the initial sales amounts, they didn't want to pick her up for a sequel. So determined, she had like some time coming up this year if she didn't take on a job.
Mm.
Or do other writing, she would be able to like write the sequel in 3 months and get it out there basically. And it's not that the first novel isn't her first novel, you know, she's published other stuff under other names,
right?
But she couldn't ship the book around, so she was basically starting a Kickstarter for about $10,000, about 3,000 of that would have covered all the book costs.
Mm.
And the other 7,000 was to pay her to write the thing. It wasn't necessarily the amount, which because this was objected to, the fact that she was asking for money for living costs. And she broke down, you know, it's going to be spent on groceries and it's going to be spent on bills. It's going to make sure my people, you know, my family don't starve and, you know, and various, you know, important things like that.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, we're talking $7,000. So actually more like in our money, you know, about £3,500 to £4,000, which for 3 months. It's about
average wage.
Yeah, it's average wage, basically. So she wasn't.
She's not exactly living the high life.
No, she's not exactly living the high life.
Is that this will go on carrots and apples, and then there's the Porsche.
Yeah.
And the pool boy.
Yeah.
Gotta have the pool boy.
And yep. Everything was going fine with her campaign. Yeah, in the first couple of days, yeah. Fans of her and her and like the universe were supporting her, and she managed to raise, I think it was about $500 within like a day or something. You know, and then suddenly the whole, somebody started a thing on Twitter. I'm not sure who. There's like a Storyfy that I found, and it's linked to in everything else with a Hex Dimension article I wrote on this last week.
Yeah.
And basically. Yeah, people started attacking her for asking for cost of living in the Kickstarter.
What the hell do they think wages are?
I don't know. Yeah, it was like, I just don't understand. I couldn't tell if some of them were trolling, if some of them thought that you just shouldn't, you know, it was against any kind of principle to ask for living costs whilst being a creator for something on Kickstarter. Because to me, it makes perfect sense. If you don't have a regular job anyway, and you weren't already, and you were promising to spend your full amount of time to produce the thing,
I don't get the problem, because after all, as I've said, that's what wages are. It's not like she's doing something else, and this is just a side project. And it, you know, she said, "Yeah, I'm going to smoke myself to death, and this is the budget. I want you to kickstart." You know, a really bad emphysema.
But even if that's what she's done, I don't see what people's problem is with it. They either back it or they don't.
It's there. It's up front. I think she did the right thing. I don't get the...
because of the amount of virtual that was held at her on Twitter, she gave up, and then she basically, within about 3-4 days of starting the Kickstarter, she closed it down. She just couldn't deal with the hassle. She's basically moved on to other projects and that now. The Twitter account that she'd been using under the name Stacey J is now pretty much silent at the moment. She's posted something else since last week, but she's moved on. She's just like, no, can't deal with this hassle. And another thing was the people were pointing out, because like after deciding that her asking for money for food was unreasonable, they then moved on to the why is she asking for money for the novel in the first place? It seems unusual that a publisher wouldn't pick it up for a second printing within, you know, and it was less than a month since it was published, because the book came out on December 9th, and she started the campaign around, I want to say, like just after New Year's.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, that's too soon, blah, blah. And I was like thinking to myself, well, it's not too soon in publishing. If a book doesn't sell quick enough within its first couple of weeks, then sometimes they won't be interested, and that's what's happened here.
Because the could well have said, well, we'll release it now, and you know, this is a good time because people will be picking up you know, Christmas presents and, you know, things like that. And if it does more than X amount, then yeah, we'll take you on. If it doesn't, you know, we won't. And if it didn't,
Decisions are made in all forms of media all the time. All the films don't get a sequel based on their opening weekend.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
And it was a combination of people who either didn't want to understand or just didn't understand at all how these things work. I had one person, you shall remain nameless, suggest to me that originally that Kickstarter doesn't allow these things, and I did a check of the terms all over the site, from guidelines to terms to the legalese and that. And there's nothing on Kickstarter these days, if there ever was, that says you can't, you can't, basically there's nothing that says you can't use it for cost of living.
Oh, bearing in mind that it's not going to go just towards the cost of living. No. You gotta produce something out of it, regardless.
Which was what was going to happen. If she didn't, then it's like, well, then you can pursue the individual under the usual terms for dealing with people who don't deliver the goods that were promised.
But it's also the fact that she was upfront about it as well. It's
She was her pitch, she was incredibly upfront about the fact that a huge chunk of the money was going to go towards supporting her so she could work on the book full time for 3 months. And I know I've seen other Kickstarters where it's kind of hinted at that money might be spent on costs of living, but it's never said as outright that that's what's happening.
Yeah, because I've seen several where they'll say, you know, this money will allow me to give, you know, full time to Project X. And of course that's what it bloody means. Because if they, you know, if they had to, you know, go out and earn a wage to pay all the bills, they wouldn't be able to give, you know, this, you know, whatever project they're kickstarting or Patreoning or, you know, whatever their full time. So it's right there. Except they might not have said, yes, I'm going to be spending, you know, this amount on, you know, food or bills.
Yeah. Another thing that annoyed me was people suggesting that, because she was asking for living expenses, the project would have been better off on Patreon, which doesn't make sense when she was producing a single end product.
Yeah, because isn't that kind of a moral and an ongoing...
Yeah, the whole point, the model of Patreon is you're producing something, you know, either every day, week, month.
Because after all, you are being their patron.
Yeah.
Whereas with Kickstarter, it's, I am going to be doing this. This is the product.
Yeah.
This is what will be, you know. But, I just don't.
The Patreon thing is a bit of annoying. Like, people was like, no, they should use Patreon. And they couldn't be bothered to think about how that was about it. Obviously, the whole thing with Kickstarter, if you're producing, obviously, a single end product, is that you get a minimum lump set of money that once you've successfully funded the project. And fees and stuff. And if you've accounted in your fundraising how much is going to be taken away in fees and then in like a certain percentage of cards that don't check through, then you've got a budget. And then you can say, well, I'm going to spend this much on this and then this much on this. Patreon, you have no set amount of income.
Yeah.
So it could vary from week to week, month to month, how much you actually have coming in. With Patreon, it could be, you could have a bunch of people, if you have a bunch of people in 1 month go, oh, I can't afford it this month, cancel what they're paying in, suddenly you haven't got the financial security that you had with having a set amount of money already to one side that you're budgeting from. So you've got the added stress of that, so that's going to detract from your ability to actually work. And then with the fact of the Patreon, because of the risk of that happening, you then have to be constantly advertising what you're doing and the Patreon itself in order to get people to keep signing up to it to deal with the people that would sign off from it.
Yeah.
Which means then that you're defeating the object of actually taking time off to write the thing because you're busy faffing about with Patreon.
This isn't the first time I've heard people be a little bit odd when it comes to Kickstarter. Let's see, there was... what's her face? She's married to Neil Gaiman. Amanda Palmer.
What's she doing?
I think she did something where she was offering, people to, you know, a chance to come on stage and play with her band. And people took exception at that because I can't remember the exact basis of it, but it was like, oh, because you're doing this, and you go, well, you know, you're just trying to get people to come up for free and, you know, play an instrument for you and such, and it was just no. And it was, I think it might have been Dreamfall Chapters, which, you know, recently got kickstarted and the first episode was actually released. I think it was that, possibly Witcher 3, but I'm thinking, you know, it's far more likely to be, you know, Dreamfall, where I think they asked if people had music that, you know, they thought, you know, could fit the game, and they were giving them a chance to, you know, contribute it. But very quickly, some people go, "Ah, you're just trying to get money for, you know, music for free, and you should be doing all the, you know, the music yourself through the Kickstarter music, you know, budget that we gave you." And it was just, yeah. So it seems to be, if anything's slightly crowdfunded, people can get a little bit weird,
yeah,
about, you know, budgeting and what they think it should be spent on, because they seem to think that because they've contributed to it, then they've got more of a say. And it's, well, I don't think you have, if it's, you know, if it's right there to, you know, to start off with, if you know what it's going to be spent on. If someone changes it to, you know, I'm buying nuclear warheads for North Korea, then yeah, I think, yeah, you could probably got, you know, have grounds to complain to Kickstarter over it, but
it kind of ignores, though, that what happens in actual business, though, because
yeah,
as soon as you've got multiple persons working in a business, not everyone knows what's going on with stuff and has a say. Like, even though, say, you've got a huge global corporation with a, you know, like a CEO, he or she doesn't know the details of every single email that's going to be sent out as a paid-for email marketing campaign.
Yeah.
You know, it's not relevant. So, and they're the one investing, especially their stakeholder, investing money in the business. So one could argue, you know, it's all good and well people having a degree of transparency on a Kickstarter, but people who actually fund stuff on Kickstarter don't necessarily have a complete say on how the money's spent. And yeah, certainly if the project doesn't go according to plan, and people have to find alternative solutions to things, then you're less likely to want to get people involved anyway, because you're probably going to go and seek professional help at that point, you know, to try and problem solve things. Or even in the case of, like, people might not use Kickstarter when they suddenly find that they've gone over budget.
Yeah.
Like, I've funded at least one film where they were like, due to technical problems and trying to get, like, permits to film somewhere or something, because they went over budget, and they had to go to Indiegogo to raise some extra funds in order to finish filming. So, you know, stuff like that happens. But I can't help but wonder, with the case of Stacey J, whether or not it was slightly woman trying to do thing, internet no like, and just throwing crap at her.
It's very possible. I mean,
certainly suits the theme of the internet.
Yeah.
Throughout most of the things that I've heard recently about, you know, being targeted, it's mostly women and Phil Fish from Fez. Now, I still have no idea what the problem was with, you know, Phil Fish and Fez.
Oh, it's because he spoke up about stuff. He had opinions.
He had opinions that people didn't like, and so they basically just tried to boo him out of the games industry.
He became the go-to for getting angry video game dev. And people would purposefully, you know, go to him and basically just try and get on his wick.
Goad him.
Yeah, and it's just, don't do that. Don't be a dick. It's, oh, you're being a dick.
But equally, Fish is perfectly capable of being a dick himself.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely, yes. But I couldn't help but, you know, feel sorry for him. With, you know, the amount of stick he would get, it's like, yeah, just, okay, if he's going to be a dick, then he'll be a dick, but don't purposefully, you know, poke the cage.
No, and the thing was, if you don't like his particular, and if you don't like his particular brand of dickery, you don't have to follow him, you don't have to pay attention
and
to
him. If you don't like this particular Kickstarter campaign, you didn't have to say a word, because all you had to do was not fund it.
Exactly.
It's such a crazy idea.
I know.
It's kind of bizarre how people, you know, people seem to have this kind of idea of, you know, oh, if you don't like something, don't fund it. And, you know, that's fair enough. But then they go a step further and try to actively damage, you know, the Kickstarters and, you know, kind of all sorts of things that they don't like. And it's like, well, you either believe in this kind of concept of, you know, stick your money where your mouth is kind of capitalism, or not, and you can't really have it both ways.
Oh, there was another element to the complaints against the campaign as well, because that was still kind of tied to her asking for cost of living, and that there were some people going, oh, well, I didn't publish blah, blah, or this person didn't publish blah, blah, but asking for living costs with their Kickstarter. You know, why can't she just have a job and work full time? And then obviously the whole, you know, well, then she's not going to be working on things. She's going to be having to work a job rather than write the thing happening. And author Chuck Wendig, who did Mockingbird, he's got a bunch of supernatural novels out, and he's quite vocal on Twitter about a lot of writerly things. And YA author Laura Lamb did like this joint blog post on Chuck's blog where they tore into this whole, like basically the people that had gone after Stacey and their arguments. And one thing Chuck pointed out, well, just because you didn't have things in the past doesn't mean people should be forced to not use them now when they are here. It's like, yeah, okay, people did work a job and write, like people like Stephen King did, you know, before he became successful, and he worked a job, wrote Carrie sort of thing.
Yeah.
But if there's other avenues available now, then perhaps people should take it, considering also that for first-time authors now, a lot of the time, publishers treat them like shit. You don't get a lot of people don't get advances and stuff like they used to. So then it becomes like, well, you would still probably have to be working a job whilst writing this novel if you've managed to get an agent, and that agent's managed to get your book that you haven't quite finished yet near the nose of a publisher who's then interested in it. So, you know, maybe it would be more economical for you to actually, you know, get together the kind of like the sample, the sort of bones of the book, run a Kickstarter, get the money, pay for your living costs whilst you finish the book, and then get the book out under your own steam.
But even returning to that idea of funding from the publisher, the advance, exactly the same as in the record industry, it's not a bunch of money that they get to use willy-nilly. It's a loan. It has to be paid back.
Well, it's not necessarily, it has to be paid. It's like in the case of an author, then it's like, oh, you get the advance, but then you don't get any royalties from your book until the publisher has made that amount of money off of the book. And obviously, I suppose the cost of publishing as well. So, yeah.
But no, I had a point and then I lost it.
Sorry.
That's all right.
I'll just say that I've been doing a quick look up of the Amanda Palmer Kickstarter thing, you know, thing. It's because she had a successful Kickstarter for a tour, but then as part of it, she put out a thing saying we'd like to, you know, if anyone can do, horns or strings, if you want to pop up on stage and play for us, you know, with us, then, you know, that would be great. But people took exception to the idea that she had a successful Kickstarter, but then wasn't offering to pay the musicians who, you know, jumped up to do it in the individual cities. And it's like, ah. I'm sure it's a little bit more complicated than that, because it goes into all the actual funding and how much the tool will cost. But yeah, it's, you know, people can be still be a little bit strange and, you know, leap to conclusions.
I mean, you said just a moment ago about the concept of doing, like, writing a book or making a film or making a game and whatnot while you're in full-time employment as well. And a lot of the time, that's kind of how projects die, because people don't have enough time to actually, you know, do them before life takes over.
Yeah.
You know, so I think I don't like the idea that, you know, people are, you know, basically stopped from doing what they want to do because they have to do something that they don't want to do instead in order to just live.
One of the greatest things that can stifle a creative process is work.
Because you're knackered.
Yeah, you need to play. You need the downtime. You need to go off on a little adventure. If you're going to create anything, you need that downtime. You need your brain to run riot and go crazy. Mm. And you can't do that if all you're doing is thinking about spreadsheets and cooking tea and hoovering the living room. And it just can't happen.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, I think on that note, I think I'm going to have to say that is all we've got time for this week. So it's goodbye from...
Kevin. I'm on Twitter as @FairlyWaley.
is good night from me, Paul Wood. I'm on Twitter as Super Retroid and Retroid on Eurogamer.net. Is that slightly screwing it up? Never mind.
I feel like there's a real brain fart there.
Yeah.
And it's good night from me, Paul Blewett. And I'm on Twitter as at Paul Blewett.
And it's good night from me, Emily King. I'm on Twitter at EK6891. You can see if I actually make any more progress with this cushion cover at geekyknittingexperiments.tumblr.com. You can find NerdAssemble over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk. You can also find us on iTunes and Stitcher. We're on Twitter at NerdPodcast, plus we're on Facebook and Google Plus as NerdAssemble Podcast. Don't forget to, A, you know, check out that lovely survey at bit.ly/nerds2015. And don't forget to check out hexdimension.com because there's shizzle there, I hear.
Well, yes, we're not going to point you to a blank website.
At the same time, though, you could. Oh, imagine if you had a blank website. And actually, it's not really blank. It's just if you sort of leave it there for a moment and then like stuff suddenly appears and scares people.
You could probably do that.
Yeah.
But why would you want to?
Because of the internet.
Yeah. People living in a post kind of like Ringu sort of like age, you know, having scary things happen when you least expect them on a blank web page. Yeah.
I know, but that's given me an idea for like almost like a Russian roulette website where it basically just redirects you to another random website. I reckon that'd be kind of...
Join us in our new podcast series, Web Development Ideas 1.0, coming soon.
Well, we give you the worst web ideas ever.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Ciao.